Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, March 9th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
For more than a year now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been one of the most controversial figures in American government. As Secretary of Health and Human Services, he's taken a sledgehammer to parts of the nation's public health system, changing vaccine recommendations, rewriting dietary guidelines, slashing research funding, and firing thousands and thousands of federal health workers. His supporters say he's finally confronting the root causes of Americans' chronic disease crisis, everything from ultra-processed foods to environmental toxins, while his critics say something very different, that Kennedy is undermining decades of scientific consensus and eroding trust in public health. So today, we're going to do a check-in. What is actually changed in American health policy under RFK Jr.? What parts of the MAHA or Make America Healthy Again agenda resonates with voters, and which parts are raising alarm among doctors and scientists? We have two really great guests who are going to help us parse through all of this, and we want to hear from you as well. What do you think RFK Jr. is getting right, and what do you think he's getting wrong? You can give us a call. The number to dial is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can leave your comments in the chat.
And, you know, he's such an interesting cabinet secretary on so many levels,
Cherry.
Obviously the name, right? He's a Kennedy. He's been in the public consciousness for a long, long time. But I can't think of any other cabinet secretary, at least off the top of my head, who you could say they almost have like their own constituency, or they are the figurehead of their own movement, one that doesn't overlap perfectly with the president's, you know, base movement, right? It overlaps somewhat, but not perfectly. And so he's an interesting figure to look at from that perspective. And of course, the things that he's done are very out of character when you compare them to past, you know, HHS secretaries. So I think it's going to be a really rich
conversation. Yeah, he's not really a health professional. He's a lawyer.
He is a lawyer indeed. So give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. We're going to get to that conversation in about 10 minutes, but first, a trio of local news stories, and we have to start with the tragedy last night in Chester County. In what is being described by authorities as a murder-suicide, a motorist shot and killed Pennsylvania State Trooper Timothy O'Connor during a traffic stop before then taking his own life. O'Connor was responding to reports of erratic driving. He stopped a vehicle in West Calm Township around 8:30 p.m. According to investigators, within seconds, the suspect in this stopped vehicle began firing from inside the car, killing Corporal O'Connor. Officials say the suspect then exited the vehicle and shot himself. They have not released this suspect's name, but they say he was a 32-year-old Chester County resident. Governor Josh Shapiro addressed the public outside Paoli Hospital Sunday night.
As I told his wife, Casey, his mother, Maureen, and his father, Tim, there are many questions, many of which will go unanswered. But the one thing we absolutely know for certain is that their son, their husband, was a hero. He died protecting others. And that is a noble calling.
The governor has ordered flags flown at half staff in Corporal O'Connor's honor.
Yeah, and it's being reported that Corporal O'Connor, in addition to his parents and his wife, he also had a very young daughter. So it's such a tragedy. Of course, the Chester County DA's office is part of that investigation. They said at this point it's unclear what the suspect's motive was. They're looking into his background. Just a very tragic situation. And, you know, our police officers, our law enforcement, put their life on the line every single day. So,
story number two, unfortunately, also a story of violence. Cherry, go ahead.
Yeah, three Pennsylvania men, including a teenager from Bucks County, accused of throwing Let me start over. Three Pennsylvania men, including a teenager from Bucks County, accused of throwing a homemade bomb, were among six people arrested during a protest in New York City. The latest development, according to the New York Times, is that this incident was allegedly inspired by ISIS and is being investigated as an act of terrorism. All of this took place on Saturday during a Stop the Islamic Takeover of New York City. It was a demonstration outside of the official mayoral residence of Zohran Mamdani, the city's first Muslim mayor. The rally was organized by Jake Lang, a far-right influencer, and he came with a group of about 20 people. Well, apparently, there was a counter-protest that developed, and then there was this clash, and that is when authorities accused 18-year-old Amir Balat of Langhorne of throwing an improvised explosive device and another smoking projectile toward a group of people during that protest. That device was one of multiple devices that was found near this protest. And the New York's police commissioner said that the devices contained TATP, which is a dangerous and highly volatile homemade explosive that has been used in IED attacks around the world. So this is pretty serious. And according to the Inquirer, a second man, 19-year-old Ibrahim Kayumi of Newtown, is accused of helping Balat, and it's unclear at this point what charges they'll face. A third man from Philadelphia was also arrested for pepper spraying people during that crowd. But at least one of the men said that they were inspired by ISIS.
And just to clarify, the man from Philadelphia, he was part of, we believe, the original protest group that was a right-wing aligned group. And he, from what has been reported, pepper sprayed some of the counter protesters. So yeah, this is a confusing incident on so many levels. The FBI did go to a home in the Philadelphia suburbs as part of this investigation. We don't know if it's the home of either of these two men, exactly what will unfold. You know, we'll all wait and see, but certainly a chaotic, confusing, and scary situation in New York City with multiple connections to our region.
Third story
here. This is an interesting little development in local journalism. The Philadelphia Inquirer is trying to expand its suburban coverage by using AI tools that do some of the watchdog reporting that human reporters used to do. So this story comes via the Wall Street Journal, and I was really fascinated by this. They profiled how the Inquirer is using these AI tools to do coverage in the suburbs that they used to be able to do with human reporters. That would include like going to town council meetings and school board meetings and finding out what was bubbling under the surface. Well, now apparently the Inquirer is using AI tools that kind of scrape all of the public meetings that are happening out there and alert human reporters to maybe when a big story might be breaking or developing. And there are four newsletters that the Inquirer rolled out last year that are fueled by these AI powered tools developed in conjunction with OpenAI and Microsoft. And the sort of the bet here is that the Inquirer can go back to doing some of the robust suburban coverage it used to do when it had a much larger staff.
Yeah.
I think this is something that we're all going to be contending with.
I mean, but you can't be mad at the Inquirer because industry pressures, right, decreased ad revenue, right? And this has caused newsrooms to sort of downsize, but there's still a lot of news to cover. So how do you do that with less people? And so AI can be a help in that regard. And newsletters, according to their reporting, is a major driver of subscriptions. So in order to get that revenue back up and to be able to bring more people, you got to have more news. And so AI can be helpful. It made me think in high school, my first job at a television station was logging tape.
Yeah.
And now there are AI tools that log tape.
Right. So what does it do to entry level positions? How do you get your foot in the door?
Yeah, that means that a job like I had in high school no longer available, but it gets done faster. We have access to transcripts a lot quicker.
Yeah,
and you have less people. Yeah.
And look, we're both journalists, so this is personal for us. But I think it's worth noting that the years of people going to every, you know, town council meeting and school board meeting are long, long gone.
Mm-hmm.
That had already really been replaced in some ways by
documenters. Remember those people? The trained regular folks. Yeah.
There are very few documenters. I don't even know. I don't think that was ever gonna be a sustainable model. But oftentimes what reporters would do is like go into neighborhood Facebook groups and ask people what's going on. There was already like a technological distance that had grown between what was happening on the ground and how these, you know, communities were being covered in reality.
Yeah.
And now you've inserted AI into that equation. There's maybe a slippery slope argument here that these tools are being trained to eventually replace reporters, which they could be.
Mm-hmm. But right now,
but right now they're just filling a vacuum.
Yeah.
There was a vacuum that had developed. There was very little suburban coverage because there's like thousands of these meetings and you could not possibly pay someone to cover all of them. And so now you have a tool that's out there scraping the minutes and the video and seeing kind of what's bubbling to the surface.
And then the other argument is, could this free people up to do investigative work that only humans can do? Meet with sources, all those kind of things.
Right, right. So, exactly.
Yeah. So we're having a serious conversation about the impact of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on American public health. We'll have that conversation after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And from WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Eric.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been at the helm of the Department of Health and Human Services for over a year. And in that short time, he has tried to reshape our public health institutions and their priorities.
Kennedy has fired tens of thousands of HHS employees, cut billions of dollars in research funding, and changed longstanding medical recommendations on vaccines, fluoride, painkillers, and antidepressants. Those moves have drawn a lot of criticism from the medical and scientific communities, but his focus on healthy eating, food additives, and ultra-processed food has won more bipartisan support.
Still, some supporters in his Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA movement, have vented frustration that Kennedy isn't going far enough. So today, we're looking at what Kennedy has accomplished and what his MAHA movement could mean for medical research, food policy, and trust in our health institutions. And joining us today are two journalists who closely follow the health secretary. We have Lauren Weber, Washington Post Health and Science Accountability Reporter, and Alice Callahan, New York Times Nutrition and Health Reporter. Alice, Lauren, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, it's great to be
here.
Thanks for having us. We'd love to hear from you this hour as well. What do you think RFK is getting right or wrong? Email studio2 at whyy.org. Hop on the phone and give us a call, 888-477-9499. If you're streaming, how you doing? YouTube, Facebook, put your comments in the chat.
And Alice and Lauren, we just gave a long list of changes made by Secretary Kennedy. And I want each of you to give, from your perspective, what is the most significant way you think he has changed federal public health since taking office? And Alice, we'll start with you. How has he changed the system? What's the most significant way from your perspective?
You know, I think probably the most significant thing he's done on the food side is just really elevate food issues so that they are central to the conversation. And he's made it clear that it's a big priority in his agenda to address food issues. So we often hear him talking about, you know, the issues with ultra-processed foods, the problems with the American diet, just really being kind of not designed to promote health. He's often using very inflammatory language. And, you know, even, I don't know, a week or two ago, he was on, you know, Joe Rogan talking about these things. He, in public appearances, is talking about the amount of sugar and Dunkin' Donuts beverages. So as a health secretary, just to be kind of constantly talking about food, he's really brought these issues to the center of a lot of conversations about health in this country. You know, what he'll actually do in from a regulatory sense, I think, is still an open question. We can talk more about that, but there isn't a ton that's like in the rule books now because of his tenure.
So he's made food and how we process food, all of that, a centerpiece of our conversation. I like that. Lauren, from your perspective, what do you think the most significant thing that the secretary has done thus far in his tenure?
Look, we've never seen a secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services who
is an anti-vaccine activist. This is a man who founded and has worked on anti-vaccine. He founded an anti-vaccine group and has worked on anti-vaccine issues for many, many years. And he took that ethos with him into this position. He has disparaged vaccines. He has upended the public health system around vaccination, changing the childhood vaccine schedule, and a variety of other things. But these are things he doesn't want to talk about right now because it's not a popular issue ahead of the midterms. So it's really interesting because he did a lot on vaccines in his first year in office, but also talked a lot more about food because it's a more popular and populist issue that helped to get him into this job.
Can we drill down a little bit, Lauren, on what he's done when it comes to vaccines? Not what he said necessarily, because that's probably going to take up the rest of the hour, but what he's actually done in the first year on vaccines. It seems like a lot of it revolves around this advisory committee on immunization practices, his reappointment of that board, and then what they've done subsequently. So can you just give us some of the highlights and then maybe draw one or two out that you're like, this is the one worth paying attention to. This is actually consequential and not just symbolic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest, more consequential piece of this was in January, his health department moved to change the childhood vaccine schedule. They moved several vaccines from being on the childhood vaccine schedule to being discussions with your doctor. So there's still, you know, discussions with your physician, but it makes it somewhat easier potentially for children to opt out or parents to opt out. And could have ripple effects at the state level. But as you mentioned, the Federal Advisory Committee, over the summer, he fired all the members of this Federal Advisory Committee that advises the CDC on best vaccine practices and replaced it with many handpicked folks, many of whom also have expressed, you know, skeptical beliefs about vaccines or anti-vaccine sentiments. One even came from an anti-vaccine group, and they have worked and have issued reports and said various things that have undermined trust in vaccines and have tried to move towards, you know, other efforts that disparage them or that limp, you know, that work to see what they could do regulatorily wise around vaccines going forward. And so I think it remains to be seen how this all continues to play out. As I noted earlier, vaccines aren't particularly a popular issue right now in the Trump administration. There's been polling that has come out to show that the general public in general supports vaccination. And since that January action, they've been talking a lot less about vaccines in the run-up to the midterms here in the fall.
Yeah, quick follow-up question to you, Lauren. I wonder how, you know, getting rid of this advisory group and bringing in new folks, how have you seen the process of how the Department of Health and Human Services would actually do business and evaluate science? How have you seen it change with regard to vaccines and maybe even other things under this secretary?
Yeah, I think even beyond the ACIP committee, in general, this secretary often and his department will say, you know, look, we're following gold standard science. We want to restore trust in public health institutions, but public health experts have said they've done the opposite. They have really torn apart the public health establishment. You know, it's worth repeating, vaccines are safe and effective, and oftentimes the things that Kennedy says, you know, it can be misleading or disparaging about vaccination, some that he said in the past and even some statements as secretary himself. I mean, it's worth noting recently, I had a piece, you know, Kennedy has disparaged the flu vaccine many times before taking office and even in office. But it's also something that he links to his voice condition. But many medical experts that I spoke to said there's no scientific evidence to back that up. And so with many policy decisions at HHS, you know, public health experts have been somewhat aghast at how it seems like the science is not underlying them.
We'd still love to hear from folks this hour. What do you think RFK is getting right or wrong in his first year on the job? Email studio2@whyy.org. You could call 888-477-9499. Laura is a critic and says, I wonder how many MAHA followers are aware that RFK Jr. is a lawyer and has made his living on lawsuits. He's not a food science expert. He's not a doctor. He's not a scientist. And he has no training of any kind that makes him an expert on anything but using misinformation to gin up lawsuits to advance his bank account. That's Laura's perspective. Look a Bear on YouTube says, I agree with removing things like Red 40 and such from food, but how are you not going to then really fight and push back with the EPA rolling back the use of harmful chemicals linked to cancer, I think probably referring to a recent executive order that has to do with the production of what is most commonly known as Roundup, the herbicide. I'm curious, Alice, do you feel like a year into this, the MAHA movement, whatever that is more united and stronger, more fractured and weaker? You know, I said at the top of the show, what makes him a little bit different than other cabinet secretaries is he really comes into this with a like real grassroots constituency that exists in the real world and would exist whether or not he was in this position or not. And I'm curious what you make of sort of the momentum or maybe lack of momentum surrounding that movement a year in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to say. It's sort of like with every new story that kind of comes out of the movement and around Secretary Kennedy, we often see some signs of fracturing. But then the movement seems to kind of scramble to, you know, reassure everybody that things are that they're still intact and strong. And so I think it's really hard to say where people are landing with this. I do think, you know, I completely agree that the food issues are much more popular, more palatable, kind of in terms of broad support across the movement. And we're definitely seeing Kennedy really stick close to those food talking points.
Within those talking points, are there like a couple that you think are especially strong or palatable politically? Because we see all sorts of stuff, red meat, whole milk, no dyes, no ultra processed food, eat real food, et cetera, the Mike Tyson Super Bowl commercial. Like, do you have a sense from what in that kind of milieu is landing with people or is broadly popular and what might feel a little fringier and maybe closer to that vaccine conversation?
I mean, I think people are excited about the eat real food message. In terms of the base and sort of what resonates with people, certainly the Mike Tyson commercial on eat real food and avoid processed food hit a lot of people. Again, it's just like a lot of conversations. People like talking about this stuff. But in terms of sort of tangible changes to the food system, that's something we haven't seen yet, and it really remains to be seen. So I do wonder if this movement will start to get impatient on that. Kennedy has talked about changes like closing the GRAS loophole, which would make it more difficult for food companies to introduce new food ingredients. And potentially reevaluating some ingredients that are currently used in the food supply. But whether or not that will happen, that does require more regulation. This is an administration that has said that they do not want more regulations. They've also cut a ton of staff and many of the things that they talk about doing, like reevaluating safety of food ingredients, will require the expertise of staff at HHS agencies. And it's not clear that exists. So I think there just are a lot of open questions about what can actually be accomplished on food beyond all of the talk.
Yeah. And by the way,
some of the things that resonate, I think, with this space are not really evidence-based, you know? And so it's not clear that, that for example, taking on seed oils, which Kennedy has talked about seed oils as being bad for health, you know, there's really not evidence to support that. And so kind of drumming up excitement about these issues that are not evidence-based, they may be popular with certain parts of the MAHA base, but whether or not that will lead to, you know, people improving their health, that seems unlikely if we're not sort of basing the information and policy actions and evidence.
Yeah. By the way, we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. What do you think RFK Jr. is getting right? What do you think he's getting wrong? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can keep those comments coming in the chat. Citizen Dave wrote about he said, well, they stole the idea from Michelle Obama. However, be it as it may, I think some things like taking the dyes and unhealthy ingredients from the food chain will be beneficial for Americans. I would encourage them to just copy the food code of the European Union. That's Citizen Dave talking on Facebook. Lauren, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation and sort of talk about impact, because, you know, there's been a lot of things that we've seen shift. And we used to get a lot of signaling from our Department of Health and Human Services. How has that shifted? And what does it look like as far as the American people sort of looking to this agency as the authority when it comes to public health?
Well, polling numbers recently have indicated that the American trust in this agency and in RFK has fallen. So, you know, the polling numbers aren't great on that front. I think it's important to, as Alice was discussing, as we were discussing on food, to think about this MAHA movement is really interesting because it doesn't really fit a neat political pattern, much like Kennedy himself doesn't fit a neat political pattern. I mean, this is a man from one of the storied Democratic families who ran for president, you know, now is in a Republican institution. And I think some of the issues you have of the MAHA movement fitting inside this box are because, as Alice pointed out, their beliefs stretch many different, you know, political and or other issue thoughts. And so as this administration tries to message, I think it's running up against the fact that the administration itself sometimes is at conflict. You know, you had the recent glyphosate order. You also had an order from the EPA that would allow for an increase in mercury in the air. So, I mean, these are issues that MAHA activists care a lot about, but the administration itself is ruling differently than they would go for. And I think there's a real question on if there will be a political home for these folks come the midterm elections and what that home will be.
Yeah, and I had a quick follow-up for you as well, Alice, because as Citizen Dave mentioned on Facebook, I mean, you know, the eating healthy, removing dyes, you know, better school lunches was an issue that Michelle Obama as first lady sort of took up. And it was sort of shot down by Republicans. And yet now with this MAHA movement is something that they seem to want to embrace. Just your thoughts on why do you think it resonates with this political party at this point, whereas before it was something that everybody disagreed with?
Well, I do think that is a credit to Secretary Kennedy. You know, he really made these food issues Republican issues. And, you know, that just wasn't the case before. We saw maybe some bipartisan support for, you know, taking on the sort of problems of ultra-processed foods back before the election, before Trump was elected to the second term. So there was more conversation about these problems, but I do think Kennedy really sort of brought Republicans and red states into the fold, and, you know, tapped into something which, you know, I think is real, that parents especially are concerned about the healthfulness of the foods that their children are eating. And there's a very strong contingent of the, you know, so-called MAHA moms. I know there are fathers in that group as well who care about what their children are eating. But that is something that I think a lot of Americans can get behind. But it is striking when you look at the polling. And I know, I think that this is a Washington Post KFF poll, you know, asking parents what issues they cared about. And it is like upwards of 80% of parents would love to see, say that they would support the government regulating processed foods more, you know, capping things like added sugars and looking at food additives. And so there's very strong bipartisan support for those ideas.
Speaking of which, Paul says, glad to hear about the concern for food dyes and some of the chemical garbage in our foods. That's about it. Everything else, he's out in left field, maybe right field. In this case, I don't know. 888-477-9499, studio 2 at WHYY.org. Maybe he's in center field. Left and right kind of involved in this strange coalition under the umbrella of RFK Jr. I am curious, Lauren, if you have a sense of his political clout within the administration right now after a year. We just saw his Captain Secretary get canned. Do you feel like he has the president's ear and could go further on things like food issues? Or do you think he's been sidelined at all in this first year? Do you have any sense of that, Lauren Weber?
I think it's a good question. I mean, I think we have to remain to be seen. I think Kennedy is only as useful to the president as he is in delivering the base for the midterms,
yeah.
Which is why I think you've seen this switch in some of the conversation from the vaccines to food in the last couple months. And so I think it depends on how he's able to rally this crew going forward. I think if he becomes more of a liability, there could be a switch up. But as of right now, it doesn't seem like that's in the works. You know, he is very popular. Someone once said to me, one of his allies once said to me, have you ever known a health secretary that the vast majority of the population knows who it is? I mean, it's true. Can you think of any other health secretaries that you know their names off the top of your head? No, I don't think the average American would be able to name one. So, I mean, to that extent, he has a lot of name recognition. He seems to command a political movement. But, you know, Trump is a ruthless politician. And if that political movement fractures or is no longer useful, that's when I think you would see a change happen.
And to that point, Lauren, I guess one of my other questions is, do you have a sense or is there data that suggests how much his various viewpoints or the things that he's skeptical about are filtering into like common opinion or changing the way consumers behave in the marketplace? Like, because there's a part of me that says like exactly how you laid it out, like he's got name recognition, he's got a real movement behind him. And so maybe he really is changing the way people think about their health. The other part of me says, well, a lot of the people that might have signed up to be part of the quote unquote MAHA movement were just in the MAGA movement. And then when he came on board, they're like, sure, I believe these things, but they're still eating Fritos or whatever. Do you think, is there evidence that people's behavior is changing because of the bully pulpit that RFK Jr. has?
That's a great question. I haven't seen polling that indicates change yet, but that's all. I mean, he's only been in the job a year.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think much of the conversation earlier on Michelle Obama, I mean, I do think the conversation around food has certainly encouraged a healthier America. But what I do know is from the vaccine hesitancy standpoint, we are seeing a crisis of vaccine hesitancy across the U.S. that seems to be rising. And, in my reporting, I've spoken to many families of people that are hesitant about vaccines or pediatricians who have seen more parents hesitant about vaccines, and they often point to Kennedy and Trump. So I think there will be more empirical evidence as time goes on to show that he has certainly had an impact on driving more hesitancy with some of this rhetoric around vaccines, along with the president.
Yeah. Marta from Center City says that RFK's work is a war on working people. She feels he's responsible for the death of many, especially given the rise of measles. And we're coming up on a break, but one of the things I want to talk about is some of the promises that we've heard RFK Jr. sort of make, specifically with regard to autism and other things like that. And do a litmus test on how he's doing with regard to those things, which were fairly controversial when he first came in. And so we'd love to hear from you, our listeners on the road or elsewhere. What do you think RFK Jr. is getting right? What do you think he's getting wrong? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the live chat. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. We are talking about HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's been on the job for a little over a year. He remains one of the most polarizing figures in President Trump's cabinet. And we're talking about his efforts to reshape public health.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. What do you think RFK Jr. is getting right, and what is he getting wrong? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube and Facebook, you can put those comments in the chat.
Akram in Philly, one of our regulars, says, I think the, quote, best thing RFK has done is expose the true colors of the online, quote, wellness industry. Mm-hmm. This non-regulated industry preys on the genuine desires of everyday people. Interesting email from Deborah, who says, I think there's too much money to be made to make significant enough reforms to our food supply. People will buy what is most convenient and cheapest, and sustainable, non-processed organic food is both expensive and usually takes more effort to prepare. Is that the basic conflict, Alice, where, like, we've identified that there's real political, popular wind behind the sales of what RFK Jr. wants to do around food, or a lot of what he wants to do. But it doesn't seem like all that wind is really blowing the ship forward all that much in terms of making actual policy. And is the problem basically that there is a very well-funded industry on the other side of this thing that doesn't want that ship to move forward? Or is it more complicated than that, Alice?
I mean, I'm sorry, I feel like a broken record, but we'll see on how much influence the food industry has. In terms that, you know, some of the things that this administration has talked about doing, which is like putting warning labels on the front of, or not warning labels, but like maybe stoplight labels, yeah, on the top, on the front of food packages, which would give consumers a red light if this is a really unhealthy choice. You know, that's something they've talked about doing. I think we would see a lot of pushback from the food industry on
a policy. You saying, Alice, like if they could get something like that done, it would be a signal to you as a reporter that actually this is an area where he can burrow ahead?
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, these are, that is a policy that has been shown to be effective in other countries. You know, there is a lot they could do. Like, there are some questions about whether they're putting their attention in the right places too. You know, things like sodium in our processed foods. Previously, the FDA has worked on trying to get industry to dial back levels of sodium in processed foods. They could tackle added sugars. These are some pretty basic evidence-based things that they could work on. And again, there seems to be less interest in tackling those issues as compared to some of these food additive questions. Mm. But I also just think there's, you know, again, there's a lot, there's so much talk about food, but the administration has also introduced a lot of confusion around nutrition science. There are new dietary guidelines with this new upside down food pyramid that Kennedy introduced and is promoting very heavily. You know, there are some things about it that are, you know, it is like kind of a visually appealing pyramid, and it has lots of pictures of beautiful food on it. It does emphasize this real food aspect, but it does have a giant steak at the top of it. Yeah. And it really minimizes whole grains. And that is really counter to the evidence. You know, we know that eating a lot of red meat is linked to type 2 diabetes and colorectal cancer, and whole grains are really great for your health, you know. And so there's some things like that that are being promoted that I think are just kind of puzzling and will probably lead to more confusion among consumers. Yeah. Their talk about ending the war on saturated fats, you know, it's saturated fats still remain, like there's a lot of evidence supporting the idea that that consuming too much saturated fat will raise your risk of cardiovascular disease. So sort of like throwing in all these mixed messages that I think, you know, probably are leaving consumers a little bit confused about what to eat instead of offering them really clear evidence-based guidance.
Yeah, and let's bring in a caller. We have Kevin from Abington on the line. Kevin, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I think Kennedy is bringing the wrong discussion to the front. That is, he's bringing his prejudices versus somebody else's prejudice. What he's not dealing with, and the discussion's not dealing with, is does one adult, one child die from vaccine? I'm just saying the extreme, versus keeping a million safe. That's the public policy decision, right? It's who gets to decide for the good of society, right? When I was growing up, people said to me, well, we have swimming pools and public sports. Why? Because we've solved polio. But now it's like, no, I get to make my own choices on things that kill thousands. And I think that's the discussion that's not being taken place at all, or it's taking place in very academic kind of environments, and the people aren't hearing.
Yeah, thank you. That's Kevin from Abington. And Lauren, I'd love to get your reaction, because I know there's been some reporting around sort of this whole ripple effect of people sort of taking a signal from HHS and choosing not to get their kids vaccinated. And it goes to Kevin's sort of thought, one person versus the many. Your thoughts on that, Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, the Washington Post found in a Washington Post KFF poll that one in six parents in the U.S. is skipping or delaying vaccination. That was a result we found this summer. And so, you know, there certainly is seemingly this group of parents that is very hesitant, and Kennedy's message is really playing into that. You know, I've spoken to many pediatricians across the country who have said, like I said earlier, that they hear from parents all the time who say, like, oh, you know, I heard the president and I heard the secretary say these negative things, you know, I don't think I'm going to vaccinate my child. And one pediatrician put it in pretty stark terms. She's like, it's much easier to choose not to vaccinate than it is to make a decision of, you know, if you're confused on whether that's a dangerous or not dangerous choice. And to be clear, medical experts say vaccination is safe, it is effective, and it can prevent, you know, dangerous illness. And so, you know, I think one of the main things that public health officials are worried about in Kennedy's tenure is that hesitancy, the flames around it could continue to worsen, is their concern.
Yeah, and a quick follow-up question, because another big moment, I think, in this tenure was when the president came out and told pregnant mothers not to take Tylenol or acetaminophen. And your thoughts, has that had an impact on whether or not pregnant moms and have actually made that choice?
Well, so it's interesting. There was actually a study that just came out in The Lancet last week that showed that after Trump's announcement, emergency room orders for pregnant women for Tylenol dropped about 10% compared to the months before it. Now, it's a correlation, not causation study, but it implies that, you know, Trump's words had meaning. And even though scientific communities have come out, the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American College of, I think it's Gynecologists and Obstetricians, or ACOG, they both have said there's no proven link that Tylenol is linked to autism. The president and Kennedy saying as such that they were worried about it appears to have had an impact. And so, you know, again, as Alice has said and as I have said, you know, a lot of the impact of the secretary's tenure remains to be seen from, you know, political polling and analysis on this impact over many years. But, you know, at least in this first year, there clearly are signs that the messaging is having resonance.
Speaking of The Lancet, they recently wrote an editorial that includes this quote: "The destruction that Kennedy has wrought in one year might take generations to repair, and there is little hope for U.S. health and science while he remains at the helm." We haven't talked about research at all yet, Alice Callahan. I mean, look, lots of, you know, money has been rerouted or rescinded. People have been fired. It's a very abstract thing to look at from where we're sitting and try to understand, well, what's the downstream impact on science and research? Because you're talking about maybe some study that never comes out that you never even knew could have come out. But do you think we're starting to get a handle, Alice, on what the impact has been on the research community?
Well, it's been huge. Yeah. I'm not sure that we have a handle on it quantitatively, but I can tell you from talking to researchers, it's been really harmful to early career researchers, you know, those who are, you know, in graduate school, doing their postdocs, trying to get a foothold in academic research that requires funding. It's getting harder and harder to get those grants. And then so many researchers have lost funding just in the last year, and those are projects that, you know, just get set aside and we never get to see the results from them. And I, you know, of course I focus on the food space, and I just see a kind of constant conflict between what we hear from the administration in terms of their priorities and what we actually see in terms of research projects that are funded. I was just looking back at some of the, you know, early announcements from the administration about synthetic food dyes, and they said we're working to phase these out of the food supply, not banning them, but asking food companies to stop using them. Part of that announcement was that HHS said they would invest in more research on the effects of food dyes on children. And I haven't seen anything on that. And, you know, it's that's the kind of question that's very answerable. These are ingredients we've used in our food supply for decades. And it's not would not be that difficult or expensive to fund studies that would actually give us answers about these ingredients instead of inciting a lot of fear. A lot of it is just fear, right? Or pushing the market to do certain things based on incomplete evidence. Like in the nutrition space, we're like decades behind on what we actually know, just because research has not been well funded. And despite this administration's interest in nutrition, we haven't seen any increase in funding.
Yeah, let's bring in another caller. We have Heather from Mays Landing on the line. Heather, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is this. I think that the discussion you're having is worth having, except that the real issue is his lack of qualification for the job. He's not a person of science. His opinions are just that. They're just opinions. And, you know, what are we doing? It just really reflects the current administration's penchant for not basing decisions on good science or gold standards, as you've said. I think that my opinion is just as valid. You know, I don't like dyes. I don't like processed foods. What I think about a vaccine is my opinion, but I'm not qualified for that job. And so, you know, I'm sure that he would say that if you're not a lawyer, you shouldn't dispense legal advice. Well, you know, as a non-medical person, I don't think he should be dispensing medical advice of any kind. I just think that what he's done is to really discredit and further make people afraid of public health officials.
Thank you. That's Heather from Mays Landing with her thoughts. We also have Claudia, who had a pro-Kennedy comment, who says RFK knows more about actual vaccine science than most doctors who risk losing their practice if they question the official, quote, safe and effective line. Public health lawyers don't argue cases based only on what they learned in law school. They have to do extensive research and consult with independent experts. And Lauren, I wanted to ask, I teased this a little bit before the break, but I wanted to sort of ask you about this because Kennedy had promised investigations into autism causes, environmental toxins and vaccine safety. Have you seen anything bubble up about this, or has this been sort of a thing that was promised and sort of fell away to the wayside?
It's certainly something that's been promised. I mean, folks who are familiar with the anti-vaccine movement would say that it's a whistle to his anti-vaccine base that, you know, look, I'm going to find the causes of autism and you know, that may be vaccines is the implication that they seem to hear when they hear things about autism studies. But, you know, we haven't gotten anything definitive. The most definitive that we got from them was that fall press conference about Tylenol in the White House. So, you know, it remains to be seen. You know, research does take a long time. I mean, people have been looking into the causes of autism for a very long time, so it's not necessarily surprising that they haven't been able to come up with a smoking gun. And even when they did talk about Tylenol, there was a lot of pushback from the medical community that was a bit over their skis. So, you know, I think we'll have to see what else they're able to expose on that front. But when it comes to environmental toxins, it's really interesting because it exposes that tension that we've been talking about in the MAHA movement, because the EPA has been relaxing regulations. This is an anti-regulatory presidency. And so a lot of what Kennedy and MAHA is interested in is more pro-regulation, and that's just not the Trump presidency. So, you know, kind of those opposing ideals are going to be really interesting to see how they play out.
Bert from Reading also echoed that earlier caller's comment about RFK Jr. being unqualified. I have to point out that plenty of former HHS secretaries are not doctors and they never did scientific experiments. They're bureaucrats or politicians. Mm-hmm. But I do want to use that, I guess, to examine the people, kind of his lieutenants, the people who have been empowered under RFK Jr. and whether or not how far they are outside of scientific consensus. Real quick, as we get ready to wrap up, Lauren, are there people he's appointed or empowered that are sort of way outside the mainstream that we're not even really paying attention to, but that are making real differences and making real changes, perhaps, but not generating a lot of headlines in the process?
Absolutely. I mean, we talked about earlier, but that advisory committee for immunization practices, there were a lot of folks appointed to that were pretty outside the norm when it came to vaccines. Many vaccine skeptics, some quite historical statements they had made that was pretty considered on the fringe.
Yeah.
And I would say in addition to that, I mean, he's appointed other folks, you know, someone on the, I believe it's the National Cancer Board that has supported the use of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, you know, other folks that are on other positions throughout government. I mean, he has a lot of power to bring in people that agree with his sense of sensibility and his sense of how the world should run. And I think, again, we'll have to see what kind of change they're able to accomplish and what that looks like going forward.
Well, that's Lauren Weber, Washington Post Health and Science Accountability Reporter. Lauren, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Let me also thank Alice Callahan, New York Times Nutrition and Health Reporter. Alice, we so appreciate the time.
Thanks. It was nice to be here.
And thank you to everybody who called in and all the folks who wrote in. We appreciate your input into today's show. And of course, we couldn't do anything of what we do without our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHRY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you tomorrow.